Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Richard Heinberg of the Post-Carbon Institute, who discusses recent reports on the accelerating rate of melting ice in the Antarctic and the importance of moving away from fossil fuels and toward developing renewable green energy sources. Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project, who examines state laws that prohibit millions of Americans convicted of felony charges from voting in local, state, and national elections. And Erica Eichelberger, staff reporter with Mother Jones Magazine, who talks about the significance of the May 15th one-day strike of fast food workers in hundreds of cities in the U.S. and around the world. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Bedouin village of Al-Araqib in Israel's Negev desert has been demolished dozens of times by Israeli police. The village is among dozens not recognized by the Israeli government as legal and stands in the way of planned Israeli settlements. Al-Araqib, consisting of trailers, tents, and blue tarps strapped to aluminum, has deep roots in the Negev desert going back hundreds of years. Residents report Israeli demolitions occur on a regular basis, and when a village is rebuilt, Israeli security forces move in to confiscate construction materials. Israeli authorities say they are evicting illegal squatters on state-owned land, even though Bedouin land claims go back over 200 years. According to Foreign Policy magazine, Arab Bedouin are among the poorest and most marginalized people in Israeli society. Hundreds of thousands of Bedouin fled after the 1948 Israeli-Arab War, and those who remain in Israel have few legal rights. In 2011, Israel proposed relocating 25 Bedouin villages, upwards of 70,000 people. Local Bedouin objected, and in July 2013, the scheme was condemned by United Nations Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay for what he described as decimating the Bedouins' traditional culture and social life in the name of development. The Pentagon is seeking to amend or rescind an order by military judge Army Colonel James Pohl compelling the CIA to turn over details of a secret prison program the agency operated relating to the trial of a Saudi national. Abd al-Ramin al-Nashiri is accused of being the mastermind of the 2000 bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen that killed 17 American sailors. Mr. al-Nashiri, who now faces the death penalty, was held in a secret CIA prison for 4 years, where he was subjected to waterboarding, threats with handguns and a power drill, as well as against his mother and family, and made to undergo a mock execution. The Miami Herald reports that the U.S. military board reviewing Nashiri's records from his time in secret detention says he now suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder and deep depression. During a pretrial hearing on April 14th, Judge Pohl issued an order giving Nashiri's civilian and military attorneys access to CIA information on secret prisons, including the site where he was held, and the interrogation plan used. Thus far, the CIA has failed to comply with the court order. Eugene Fidel, an authority on military justice at Yale Law School, observed, "The government is clearly nervous about protecting the intelligence community's crown jewels, which we are told must be safeguarded at all costs." Fossil fuel hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, has transformed North Dakota into the state with the fastest-growing economy and lowest unemployment rate in the nation. But it is also now one of the most dangerous places to work in the U.S., reports Mother Jones magazine. According to data compiled by the AFL-CIO, North Dakota has the highest workplace fatality rate, 17.7 deaths per 100,000 workers, 5 times the national average. That's double the state's own fatality rate prior to North Dakota's energy boom in 2007. The most hazardous jobs are not on oil rigs, but among truck drivers who are on tight schedules transporting water, chemicals, and oil. The AFL-CIO's safety director, Peg Seminario, observed the number of workplace deaths in North Dakota spiked as inexperienced workers flocked to the state eager to make big money. The oil boom also attracted new startup oil and gas companies that neglected health and safety rules. At the same time, OSHA, the federal agency that inspects workplace safety, faced budget cuts. The most serious long-term impacts of fracking operations, including exposure to toxic chemicals, are just beginning to be studied, and some health experts are worried that unless safeguards aren't strictly enforced, incidents of industry-related disease could increase in coming decades. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Two teams of scientists have reported that the Western Antarctic ice sheet is collapsing as a result of global climate change and is already triggering a rise in sea level at a faster rate than previously forecast. Researchers say that the melting of the entire Western Antarctic ice sheet may eventually increase sea levels by as much as 13 feet. These conclusions were confirmed by several years of readings from the European Space Agency's Cryosat-2 satellite. The data collected indicates that Antarctica's ice sheets are losing nearly 160 billion tons of ice per year, which is twice as much as the estimates from previous surveys. The melting, which over the next 200 to 1,000 years will inundate low-lying coastal regions across the globe, making them uninhabitable. A rise of less than 4 feet of sea level would flood U.S. coastal cities, including Miami, New Orleans, New York, and Boston, where more than 3.5 million people live today. Scientists involved in the research say the melting of the Antarctic ice is unstoppable, even with concerted and urgent action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that cause global warming. But without a rapid reduction in those emissions, the rate of melting ice in the polar regions and in Greenland will almost certainly increase. Your reporter spoke with Richard Heinberg, senior fellow in residence at the Post-Carbon Institute and author of 11 books on energy and the environment. Here he discusses the recent reports on melting ice in the Antarctic and the importance of instituting policies to move away from fossil fuels and toward developing renewable green energy sources.
Well, this study that was done by NASA and published in the American Geophysical Union Journal suggests that the melting is going to take place over a fairly long period of time, and no one can say for sure, but probably over centuries. But what's distressing is the scale of what's melting. I mean, once all of this ice is melted, the world's oceans will be over 100 feet higher than they are today. So it'll be a different world, different coastlines. And the other thing that's disturbing about this is the word irreversible. The authors of this study were very careful in choosing their words. Effectively, even if we stop burning fossil fuels today, this melting and disintegration of the ice sheet will continue in any case as a result of the greenhouse gases we've already put into the Earth's atmosphere and the self-reinforcing feedbacks that have already kicked in. So on top of the melting of the North Polar ice cap and the increasing rate of melting of the glaciers on Greenland, now we have this irreversible melting in Antarctica. It's all, as you can imagine, very, very bad news.
Richard, as someone who's studied the fossil fuel industry and the alternatives, the green alternatives to fossil fuels as our energy source, what is the most important thing that we could do now as a country and as a world community to address this? There seems to be so much climate change denial in our politics, especially in the United States, that it's dispiriting and frustrating to understand our government is really not responding to the crisis.
Well, it's important, of course, for citizens to make their voices known about this problem. You know, policymakers have a tough time with this because in order to address climate change, we're going to have to get off of the energy sources that made the Industrial Revolution and all of the immense wealth creation of the last few decades possible. I mean, fossil fuels really are remarkable from an energy standpoint. They're energy dense, in the case of oil, highly portable. Oil runs virtually all of our transportation, and we rely on that not just for, you know, getting from A to B, but also transporting food and products and manufacturing processes, agriculture, on and on and on. We're immensely dependent on fossil fuels. So getting off of fossil fuels is a big job, and it's going to entail some sacrifices. And no politician wants to get out in front of an audience and say, well, you know, we have some hard work ahead of us and we're going to have to make sacrifices. Politicians want to say, oh, if you vote for me, everything's going to be better. We'll have lots of economic growth, no problems. And that's just, unfortunately, that's not the real world in the 21st century. We have a lot of belt tightening to do. We're going to have to reduce our energy consumption, reducing our fossil fuel consumption in agriculture, and changing our patterns of transportation, land use, the way we design our cities. Lots of things are going to have to happen, and it's going to take leadership. If we're going to make it through this difficult time, we're going to have planning and leadership.
What do you think the most effective thing people who are concerned about climate change and the lack of action on the part of our government in the face of large contributions to politicians from the billionaire Koch brothers and folks of that sort who are very much, I think, steering our politics away from addressing climate change? What's an effective thing that we can all do?
Well, there's a lot, actually. I mean, working to fix our political system is one thing, but that's a long-range task. But also working locally. You know, there are wonderful programs all across the country that are regional, local, citywide, countywide, in some cases statewide, that really are working to change policies, to change our trajectory with relation to energy and fossil fuels. So getting involved in those projects locally, things like transition towns that are, you know, totally grassroots, where people just get together and say, you know, what can we do right now with what we know and the tools at our disposal? What can we do in our own lives and our own communities to reduce our fossil fuel consumption? That kind of thing is exciting, and it really makes a difference. And it doesn't require, you know, this long-range, slow, difficult process of changing our political system, which has to happen, but, you know, it can't happen overnight.
That was Richard Heinberg, senior fellow in residence at the Post-Carbon Institute and author of 11 books, his most recent titled Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Find more information on the melting of Antarctic ice and groups working to address climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In a move unusual among state election officials, Connecticut Secretary of State Denise Merrill announced on May 6th that her office is collaborating with advocates for the homeless and those convicted of felonies to encourage those groups of people to register and vote. In 2001, Connecticut reformed the state's election law, allowing individuals who have completed their parole supervision to vote, even if they are still on probation. Across the country, 35 states deny voting rights to those on probation or parole. While 12 states prohibit ex-felons from voting even after completing their full sentence, sometimes for the rest of their lives. Only two states, Vermont and Maine, permit individuals serving prison sentences to participate in elections. According to data compiled by the Sentencing Project in 2010, almost 6 million adults who were convicted of a felony don't have a right to vote. The loss of voting rights for people convicted of felony charges disproportionately affects African Americans, with 7% of blacks disenfranchised compared to 1.8% of the rest of the country. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, which promotes sentencing reform and alternatives to incarceration through research and advocacy. Here he asserts that leadership from the top is required to pass state legislation restoring voting rights to citizens convicted of felonies.
Four of the most restrictive, Virginia, Florida, Kentucky, and Iowa. In those states, every felony conviction results in a lifetime ban on voting. So everyone is affected, resulting in huge rates of disenfranchisement there. Sometimes the particular governor in office can affect how easy or difficult it is to get your rights restored because they have discretion there. So in Florida, for example, when Governor Charlie Crist was in office, he opened up the process significantly, and well over 100,000 ex-felons had their rights restored. He was then succeeded by Governor Rick Scott, who basically closed off the spigot completely, and almost no one has gotten their rights restored since he's been in office. So it's very dependent on both the policy and then this discretionary actions by governors.
Has anyone ever done a study to see what impact allowing voting has on civic participation, you know, or even recidivism?
There's only one serious study to date of a criminologist at the University of Minnesota that looks at the connection between electoral participation and recidivism, and that study suggests that people who have a criminal record already and go out and vote and participate actually get beneficial effects and reduced rates of recidivism. And, you know, these researchers recognize that these issues are complicated, and it's not just the single act of voting itself that turns everything around, but that voting in combination with other pro-social behaviors does produce lower rates of recidivism. So in addition to the questions about democracy, it turns out that broadening the electorate also can have some public safety benefits as well.
Mark Maurer, the racial composition, I'm guessing it's mostly African-American, except in Iowa, where I know there are quite a few Latinos, but I don't think too many black residents.
What we see in every state is that there are generally extreme racial disparities in the impact of disenfranchisement, which follows on the disparities in the justice system generally. So even in a state like Iowa, which has a relatively small African-American population, nonetheless, the rate of disenfranchisement for African-Americans in Iowa is far greater than for whites in that state. The other three states, Virginia, Florida, and Kentucky, that have broad lifetime disenfranchisement, the rates are just remarkable. And in those states, one of every five adult African Americans is currently disenfranchised as a result of these policies. So, you know, this is an issue for individuals and their participation, but it's at this rate and this point, it's now fundamentally a question for the African American community, and their voting power as a community is really being affected by these policies.
I assume that's one out of five African-American males?
No, that's one of every five African-Americans, male and female combined. We only have the data for male and female combined. If we were just to look at males, we know that the rates would be considerably higher than that, probably approaching 30% in those particular states.
This project is being spearheaded by Connecticut's highest elections official. Are you aware of other such officials in other states doing this?
Most of the activity encouraging people to register has been led by advocacy organizations, civil rights groups, and the like. So there are very few cases where we see high-ranking state officials actually taking this on seriously. There has been some progress in Virginia in recent years. First, Governor McDonnell, a Republican, and now Governor McAuliffe, a Democrat, have opened up the restoration process in that state. It used to be a lifetime ban with a very lengthy waiting period. Now, for those convicted of a nonviolent offense, they can apply for rights restoration shortly after they complete their sentence. It's still a problem in Virginia, as elsewhere, in that relatively few people know about the process or get much support in filling out the required paperwork and the like. So it's very important if we can have situations such as Secretary of State in Connecticut leading that effort, and that is likely to make the process go much more smoothly and encouraging people to become registered.
Even if they've never been convicted of a crime, low-income people of color are much less likely to vote than whiter and higher-income individuals. I guess this effort could help move the needle a little bit among lower-income and people of color populations?
Yeah, if there are campaigns to get out and register people to vote who have the right to vote because they've completed their felony sentences, this could potentially have a significant impact on the representation that we see coming out of these communities, so that in terms of having their political voice, access to resources and the like, the communities as a whole have been harmed by disenfranchisement policies, even though most people in those communities themselves do not have a felony conviction. It still has affected their political life nonetheless.
That was Mark Maurer, Executive Director of the Sentencing Project. Find more information on felony convictions and voting rights on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Agitation for fair compensation by low-wage workers in the U.S. was first seen in a series of protests and strikes that began in November of 2012. Then, in the first action of its kind, over 200 fast food workers participated in a one-day strike at more than 20 chain restaurants in New York City. Now, after a year and a half of organizing, the movement has gained visibility on the international stage when, on May 15th, fast food workers conducted a one-day strike in 150 U.S. cities and 80 other cities in 30 nations around the world, such as Casablanca, London, Geneva, Sao Paulo, Seoul, and San Salvador. The global action was coordinated by the International Union of Food, Agricultural, Hotel, Restaurant, Catering, Tobacco, and Allied Workers Associations. Over the past 18 months, American low-wage workers at big-box discount retailers like Walmart and employees at the largest fast food chains including McDonald's, Burger King, and Wendy's have organized job actions demanding a living wage and the right to join unions. Many of the protests have been organized by national and regional coalitions that include the Service Employees International Union, the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and two workers' committees, Fast Food Forward and Fight for 15. Workers demanding an increase in wages to $15 an hour have succeeded in influencing the national debate, with President Obama frequently calling for Congress to pass an increase in the hourly federal wage to $10.10 an hour. However, the Republican-controlled House, with support from the restaurant industry, have thus far refused to vote on raising the current $7.25 minimum wage. Your reporter spoke with Erica Eichelberger, staff reporter with Mother Jones Magazine, who talks about the International Fast Food Workers' One-Day Strike and their demand for a living wage.
So workers all around the world walked off the jobs. They went on strike in over 200 cities around the world and 150 U.S. cities and then about 80 foreign cities. And they were walking off the job at places like Wendy's, Burger King, McDonald's, KFC. And this was just sort of the latest effort in the growing fast food worker movement, whose ultimate goal is to get a wage of $15 an hour and the right to form a union without retaliation by the employer. Right now, the fast food average wage is about $8.69, so it's about half of that. This movement has been growing for the past year and a half, and this was sort of the latest and biggest effort yet.
The fast food workers movement, the low-wage workers movement, really got started in November 2012. Maybe you can talk about those early events and trace the progress these workers and their organizers have made in the intervening months.
So the first strike was, as you said, in November 2012. It was about 200 workers in New York City. The movement, just to back up a little bit, was initiated by a community group in New York called New York Communities for Change. They work on all sorts of economic justice projects. And when I talked to the executive director last November, he said that, you know, they were working on all these various projects, whether it was housing rights or stopping school closures. They started to notice that a lot of the people they were working with had fast food jobs and really just could not make it, could not get by. He said they met people who were working fast food jobs and living in the back of cars or in homeless shelters, and that's sort of when they decided to get this fast food movement going. So this community group, New York Communities for Change, started going door to door and restaurant to restaurant talking to workers and asking them if they'd be willing to organize for higher pay and rights on the job. And it turns out a lot of people were willing, and so they all got together and they organized that first strike in 2012. And since then, it's really just grown quite steadily. It seems like there have been protests maybe every, it seems like an average of like 3 or 4 months, there's another protest. After that first New York City one, the SEIU came in and helped make the movement national, helped organizing efforts around the country. So it's really just kind of been amazing to see it grow and build so quickly. I was talking to the president of the SEIU again last November, and she said already that the movement had grown way beyond her expectations.
Erica, what's the goal of these protests? Are they making a direct appeal to these big fast food companies like Wendy's, McDonald's, Burger King, and all these other internationally known fast food restaurant chains? Are they appealing directly to the presidents of these companies, or is there some other agenda that we should know about?
Well, yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think they are appealing to the high-ups, the CEOs. As I said, their demands are, you know, a $15 an hour minimum wage and the right to form a union. And while we haven't seen, you know, any sort of significant increase in wages yet by any of the large fast food companies, we have seen that these companies are starting to wake up and starting to see that it looks like they may have to respond sometime soon. My colleague, reporter Josh Idelson at Salon, reported a couple of months ago that McDonald's, in a March filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, McDonald's said that worker protests might actually force them to raise wages. So it looks like there's a growing admission that something's going to have to be done in response to these protests.
Thanks, Erica. And I wanted to ask you about a recent report that you talked about in your article. Demos, the group Demos based in New York City, recently released a study of how fast food workers compare with the CEOs that administer these giant fast food companies. Tell us about that study and how it sort of relates to the ongoing struggle of these low-wage fast food workers.
Yeah. So this study found that fast food restaurant CEOs are paid 1,000 times more than the average franchise worker who makes about $8.69 an hour. And actually, a couple of workers that I talked to when I visited a strike in New York last fall actually made that connection themselves. They said, look, these CEOs are making, you know, multiple times what we are. Profits are also at record levels. So they made that connection themselves, and it's just sort of fueling the protests. But I mean, it's going to be a pretty steep fight, just because there is so much lobbying power behind these restaurants. Another recent study found that the National Restaurant Association, which is the lobbying group for the industry, actually doubled the number of lobbyists that they have on Capitol Hill over the course of the economic recovery. So between like 2008 and now. So they're fighting hard against an increase in the federal minimum wage, as well as an increase by private companies.
That was Erica Eichelberger, a staff reporter with Mother Jones Magazine. Find a link to her recent article, Fast Food Strikes Go Global, an analysis of the growing low-wage workers movement, by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.